Welcome to the Global Health Insights podcast, where personal stories make an impact globally. Together, we'll discover the human story behind our global health heroes and their international partners. We're here to understand their motivation and discuss the future of global health. I'm Dr. Sharon Chakichian, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Yale, and it's my pleasure to have you join us. So tell me, how do things catch your attention? I mean, when I'm hearing you talk, I mean, you're talking about South Sudan to Ukraine. We've talked before a little bit about Afghanistan. How do things sort of light up on your radar? And how do you choose what to look at and what's worthy of your time? Because you can't do everything.
In this work, you have to focus. You have to focus. And in a context where all the demand signals are telling you to focus on everything. And so it requires an incredible discipline to block out the news and to be able to, it's like, this is a terrible way to put it, but it's like poker. You have a limited amount of chips and you've got to place your bets on limited and highly complex capacities. You have to place your bets very smartly. And what that means, to take it out of, you know, gambling metaphor, is what we focus on places where we can have the most impact to the highest degree in the most specific way. And so there are things we don't engage on because, A, we don't think we can make that much of a difference in terms of outcomes, or B, we could make a difference, but the capabilities we have don't fit to the target. In the case of Ukraine, and you have to figure out a lot of this as you do it. And so if you talk to me when we started on Ukraine, we were doing classic bomb damage analysis of hospitals and schools. And we're doing a lot of work on bombardment of health facilities globally, including Gaza, including Sudan. But what began as a classic bomb damage analysis mission, where open source information was supporting that, it mutates and metamorphosizes over time. By the time we got to the fall to winter of 22-23, imagery became less of the lead, and it was more and more open source methodologies on open source data sets that we hadn't really been thinking about a year before that. And so that tool-to-task match to a scenario changes over the trajectory of a conflict. And so what we work on in Sudan right now is really determined by the context. And how we work on Ukraine has changed because the target has changed.
So tell me a little bit about the law of armed conflict. You told me once, a crime is a crime.
Yeah.
And it seems like the law of armed conflict has sort of taken a priority space in your work. Tell me about how you see it going. You know, have things completely dissolved, or are we just more aware of all these violations of the law of armed conflict because we have information at our disposal?
So there's a famous line from the HBO TV show The Wire, where Omar says, "A man's got to have a code," and I think about that a lot. For me, you know, my catechism, my faith personally is LOAC, the Law of Armed Conflict. It's the Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law, and separate thing, international human rights law. And so, whenever people come to me and say, "All these horrible things are happening, which are law of armed conflict violations, does it really matter anymore?" And I have my canned response, which I will give you right now, which is that the moment we stop thinking it matters is the moment that those who will willfully violate it have won. They want us to believe it's unenforceable, and they want us to believe it's not worth it, and they want us to become collaborators in impunity. And I'm not going to do that. But let's look at the data. The work of Catherine Sickink at Harvard, Carr Center for Human Rights and Harvard Kennedy School. Catherine and I did a podcast with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs about this. And it was wonderful because it was a deeply optimistic podcast where her research shows that human rights norms, including international humanitarian law norms, over time have actually reduced the scope, scale, and severity of abuses on a global level. And so, look at even the context we're talking about here. Putin's been indicted. He's been indicted. And when you talk to Americans, there's this cynicism. They're like, well, that's great. Pat me on the head and pat the team on the head and say, well, but he's never going to face trial. But you talk to Ukrainians, and that moment of his indictment was profoundly empowering because it was a message that there is a limit, and it was a line that was drawn by the international community in the sand that this can't happen. You can't take the kids. And for them, it validated their suffering. Okay. And so my mentor, the most important mentor I have ever had professionally in my life, was Bill Haglund. And I just get emotional saying his name. He's the greatest war crimes investigator of all time. He caught Mladic for Srebrenica, and he chased the Green River Killer, one of the most prolific serial killers in American history. And so Bill passed away in 2021, and I spoke at his funeral, and he was a medical legal investigator and forensic anthropologist, and he trained me. And I said at his funeral that justice serves a lot of purposes, okay? This is what Bill taught me. He taught me four rules. Justice takes a long time. Justice serves a lot of purposes. Justice is not about you. justice, it must be done even if you don't know what it's going to mean. And the longer I've done this work now in some form for 24 years, 25 years this August, quarter of a century, and I have more faith in those rules, Bill's rules. I've seen more proof that they are true than I have seen reasons to doubt. And so for me, what is law of armed conflict? Law of armed conflict, to quote Kenzaburo Oe, the Japanese Nobel laureate in literature, it teaches us to outgrow our madness. And if that doesn't matter, then nothing does.
So you talked a little bit about Bill, but you also mentioned somebody else to me when we spoke before, Sergio.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Sergio and how he influenced you, what you learned from him.
You're speaking about the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Sergio Vieira de Mello. I never met Sergio in person, but Sergio ended up affecting the entire trajectory of my life and of Bill's. When Sergio Vieira de Mello, who was killed in 2003 in the Canal Hotel bombing as the UN special envoy to Iraq of the Secretary General, Sergio Vieira de Mello tasked Bill's team, which I was supporting, in the fall of 2001 to investigate the Dashti Laili massacre in Afghanistan. Sergio Vieira de Mello courageously called in the UN forensic team to the Dashti Laili massacre in the fall of 2001, and I was knee-high to a grasshopper as a war crimes investigator. I was at that point, 23, 24, and younger than some of my youngest team members now. And I supported Bill on the investigation of what turned out to be a mass suffocation of Al-Qaeda and Taliban surrendered prisoners just a few weeks after 9/11, so in early November to middle of November, 2001. And so Sergio Vieira de Mello, as the High Commissioner for Human Rights, sent Bill and the team to investigate that grave. And when they dug a test trench, they found what we call a sardine trench, which is bodies side by side. And as Bill and Nizam Pirwani and the other members of that forensic team that Sergio sent began to look at the bodies, they found no gunshot wounds. Their hyoid bones in the neck, which is common if someone's been strangled by ligature, were intact. But there was something weird about the fingernails. And what they observed is that the fingernails had skin cells underneath them. And then they looked at the bodies and there were scratches. And basically, these people had been in a enclosed space and they died through hypoxia. They didn't have enough air. And they were suffocated, and they were suffocated in container trucks. And so that was my first major investigation, and supporting Bill, who was lead on that, with Stefan Schmidt, who would later take over on the forensic investigation. The witnesses in that case, who were the bulldozer drivers and the truck drivers of those trucks, we know were systematically killed, and likely by individuals associated with Abdul Rashid Dostum, the warlord and U.S. ally who would later become the vice president of Afghanistan, who is allegedly responsible for that massacre. The survivors of that massacre, we know through the investigation of the FBI, became the first prison population at Guantanamo. And so for me, this is the origin story, is that grave. Years later, the grave would be dug up, we believe, by Dostum's men. And that was the first time I used satellite imagery and investigation, and that was in 2009, with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. We were able to see bulldozers and Kamaz military trucks on the site removing likely the soil with the bodies in it. And so for me, it was two events. It was what happened with my experience in Biloxi in Hurricane Katrina combined with my experience on Dashielele, which led me to where I am now. And out of the Dashielele experience, I mean, the two big takeaways is, one, the use of remote data to detect efforts by alleged perpetrators to hide their crimes. That was the first big takeaway, that you didn't have to be on the ground because it was too dangerous on the ground. People lost their lives because of being on the ground. The second thing I took away from that is an absolute ironclad focus on witness protection. And so a lot of my career is really about, and not just witness protection, how do we prevent unintended secondary consequences from investigations, from the use of technology on affected populations. So that's core to my scholarship, my practice, everything. And that really comes from Dashielele and came from Sergio Vera de Mello's courage in authorizing that investigation, which was extremely unpopular at the time. By the time Sergio died, the U.S., Colin Powell had called for an investigation into that grave, but the U.S. began to block it. And in 2009, the New York Times would release a story by Pulitzer Prize winner James Risen using that satellite imagery, using Bill's photos, using information from the investigation Sergio Vera de Mello authorized to show, and interviews with the FBI and FBI documents to show that the Bush administration had prevented a full investigation of that massacre because it involved someone who was working with U.S. forces at the time, including CIA and Green Berets, and was a U.S. ally and a CIA asset, according to documents we got through FOIA, Freedom of Information Act. And so that would lead Obama in his first months in office to authorized on CNN, in an interview with Anderson Cooper, a National Security Council probe into that massacre, which was then closed and never released. But the point is, back to Bill's rules, justice takes a long time.
So you talked about protecting people on the ground as sort of secondary victims of investigations. Mm-hmm. What about you? Are you in danger? I mean, you're investigating crimes that are actively ongoing right now or crimes from the recent past. Are you in danger?
Me and our team here at Yale School of Public Health, our daily bread is cybersecurity. The issues we face are about protecting our team's devices, protecting our team's communications, protecting the evidence, and ensuring that's done in a way that allows it to be used in court and allows us to be able to trust our own data. So really, our fundamental security concern is cyber. And Yale has been an incredible partner in this. And every day I wake up, I thank my stars to have the support of the university. And there's a lot of places that would say, oh, no thanks. And, you know, like we're cats that catch mice, but in some cases we come back with a coyote, you know, and so and that coyote is not pleased. The Yale has been committed since day one to ensuring that we have what we need to do our work and to do it safely and do it well. And and so that's something I'm extremely grateful for. Now, the bottom dollar, the brass tacks here is protecting affected populations. You know, that we're privileged. We are here in New Haven and elsewhere around the world, and we have resources for those who are in harm's way right now. They don't. And so we have to see our security is not only our security, it's the security of some of the most vulnerable people on the planet. And that's not easy.
I have one more question for you.
Sure.
You had described yourself to me as a detective for hire. What if somebody didn't hire you? What's the thing you're most curious about that you personally would love to investigate, delve into?
I prefer consulting detective. Thank you.
Consulting detective.
Consulting detective. And sometimes you're consulting without pay.
What story is personally to you most compelling? What would you like to delve into that you haven't been able to? What's the most pressing thing out there?
I've done a lot of podcasts, and that's the best podcast question I've ever gotten. I have friends who work on civil rights era cold cases, and in Mississippi primarily, and I think I've spent almost my entire career, both physically outside the United States and focused operationally, even when I'm here outside the United States. I've barely been to the American South. I think the big, you know, missing piece in my career has been work domestically. And in many ways, I've actually, you know, avoided domestic work because the cases are so different and the scale is so different. They're individual murders in most cases. And it's sort of like, you know, you being an emergency room physician, you know that, like, when you can train yourself to have clinical objectivity in certain cases at certain times, like I can work a massacre. I'm not dispassionate, but I'm able to be clinically objective. I can't watch pit bulls and parolees on Animal Planet. It's emotionally too hard. And so, like, and for me, that's how it's been on domestic cases, where individual murder cases, like of civil rights activists during the 60s, that seems harder to me because I haven't developed clinical and personal repertoires of managing that. And I think about Bill and him talking about working Green River. I mean, he was identifying the remains of commercial sex workers who had been killed by a serial killer. And I got to meet some of the law enforcement that worked with him on that. And just those who've worked individual serial killers, man, oh, man, oh, man. It's a whole entirely different thing. And so for me, I'd want to find a way to be able to help with accountability processes on issues that we still haven't reckoned with in American history, because I feel like in many ways I'm a hypocrite in the sense that I'm going to other countries and helping with their accountability processes. Okay, well, we have some things we need to be accountable for in the United States. And so I really respect those who do cold case work on anything in the U.S., but I especially respect those who now 60, 70, in some cases 80 years later, are looking into cold cases from America's history in the civil rights era. That would be something that if I could have impact on that, that would really matter.
Nathaniel, it's been great talking to you. Thank you for all the work that you're doing around the world. And I hope in retirement you get to turn your attention to some cold cases. Sounds like that's a long way off.
I'll mostly watch cooking shows.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To stay updated on the latest, don't forget to hit that subscribe button. And if you enjoy what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. Your support means the world to us.